Okay, as we continue reading through the book of Numbers, we've got this portion this week, Shalach, which means send, and it is a very, all the parashiyot, all the portions are very impactful, but this one is, I think in the book of Numbers, it's a very momentous parasha. There's a really big event which happens, which we'll talk about this week, which according to Jewish tradition has major consequences for the rest of Jewish history, so we will discuss that today. We are roughly, we're getting towards halfway in the book of Numbers. I think in the next week or two we'll be over halfway. So the story so far, again, we're through the book of Numbers, we restarted telling the narrative. So Leviticus, we took a break from the narrative, lots of laws, lots of, priestly discussions in Leviticus, but in Numbers, we restart the narrative of the Israelites through the desert. Just over 2 years have passed since Exodus, so that's where we are chronologically, about 2 years from the Exodus. And of course, they're still wandering through the desert. And a number of sensei or censuses, I'm not sure what the plural for census is, but maybe English teacher here can help me out. I was never that good at English, mind you. I mean, that's supposedly my first language. So anyway, census plural took place. So again, the book of Numbers is a very appropriate name for the book. And the Levites and the Kohanim, or the Levites and the priests, are coronated into the service of the tabernacle firstly, and then for the temple later on. The 70 elders are also set aside for the service. So the 70 elders, the 70 judges of the people, were the original Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is a Jewish court, and it's the way same way that, I guess, secular countries have a supreme court or, various different courts. The Sanhedrin was the high court, the highest court of the Jewish people, and to be in the court, it was different to being a rabbi, especially in the Sephardi or the sort of Spanish Portuguese Jewish tradition. Rabbis were not part of this court. There were specific people for the task called Dayan. A Dayan was a judge, and they were actually even higher than the rabbis. The rabbis were more of spiritual guides, but the Dayan had someone with legal authority. There are only a handful of people I know of in the past who had both of these jobs. Maimonides was one of them. Maimonides in medieval Spain was both a rabbi and a dayan at various times. So very few people had both titles. There's a lot of power invested in that. Anyway, and we also learn about the iconic laws of the Nazarite and the Sota. The Sota was the woman accused of adultery, and it was a bizarre ritual that goes with that, which is a lot of stuff for us to learn as well, but I won't have time to talk about it today. And also, we read about a Passover being celebrated in the desert as well. So, 2 years have definitely passed since the Exodus. And the Israelites can complain about the manna as well. As we learned about last week, God is angry with them, and he gives them meat, but then also a plague. So that's what Mark talks about last week, if you were here. Also, last week's portion, Miriam criticizes Moses for having a foreign wife from Midian. But God supports him, and Miriam is punished with leprosy, or tzaraat. She is later forgiven and allowed to come in back into the camp after Moses prays for her. So this week, the main event this week is a very famous event in Jewish tradition, is the sending of the spies. And the sending of the spies was supposed to be on a reconnaissance mission to see, what's the land like? Is it good? What can we expect? Lots of people, reconnaissance missions are very common in many different nations. And that is the namesake of this week's parasha, Shalach, send. So they send the sending of the spies. And the report that we read is unfortunately quite a negative report mostly. And we'll read the report together. For the list of the spies, they actually tell us who the spies were exactly by name. There is a reference for that, Numbers 13, 4 to 16, if you want to know the names of the spies. But there were 12 spies in all, one from each tribe essentially. Numbers 13, 27 to 32, this is the report. And they told him, "We came to the land which you sent us to. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit." So they were basically, it was a very fruitful land. It was a rich land. "However, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there." I put in brackets Nephilim, I'll explain what I mean. "The Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the hill country, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan." But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. Then the men who had gone up with him had said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are. So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone to spy out is a land that it devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great height. So interestingly, so Anak here, so the tenants of Anak is actually refers to giants. So as you know, remember in Genesis, there was basically a lot of really terrible things going on. You saw Nephilim, which basically wicked angels mating with mankind. There was weird, bizarre things were going on. And basically what they're saying here is like these people or these beings were ginormous and there's no way we can overcome these people. Now Caleb was very positive, was like, yeah, we can do this. God's on our side, let's go up and take it. But then, you know, I guess the pessimistic voices sort of won out. And as a result, the nation cries out in hysteria. They're basically terrified now, because despite the reassurances of Joshua and Caleb, they're obviously terrified, oh, these evil people, these big people, how are we going to conquer them? So there was a lot of, I guess, I mean, these days we call it realism. Of course, like, you know, if a nation spies out a land to conquer and they see gigantic, it's like when Mexico, if Mexico was going to invade America, you know, Mexico would do reconnaissance of America and they would see, oh, America has great military bases and great, you know, aircraft carriers, all these powerful things. They wouldn't go and try and conquer America because they're, you know, physically not powerful enough. So I guess in this sense, it can be understandable in the sense that, you know, they're spying out the land, they're seeing if they're able to conquer them. And a nation of, you know, nomads through the desert is probably, you know, on a human level, no match for a nation with gigantic inhabitants and fortified cities. Probably not. But again, Caleb is invoking faith in God, and so is Joshua, but the people have forgotten this. And some of them even want to return to Egypt. Like they say, well, why did you take us here to go here? We should have stayed in Egypt. And that's often a very painful theme throughout this, throughout the Torah, is when Israel gets into a bit of hardship, oh, we should have stayed in Egypt. Very short-term memory. Anyway. Now, God becomes furious and wants to destroy the nation. But again, Moses intervenes. Moses is a great interceder of the people. He intervenes again and he prays for the people and God relents. However, the nation is punished quite severely, actually. The 10 spies who gave a negative report died in the plague. So those people died. And the rest of the nation was spared from immediate death, but that generation who cried out would not see the land. So the reason for the 40 years, no, it was not because God, you know, got lost. It was not because they had no compass. That it was not any of those reasons. It was a punishment, and actually quite a merciful punishment. So God actually spared the generation. He allowed them to live normal lives, but anyone over the age of 20 was not allowed to go into the land. So it was a way for them to die out sort of naturally in a sort of punishment, but also a bit of mercy at the same time. So they were punished quite severely. Only Joshua and Caleb of that generation would go and see the land. Not even Moses. Well, Moses, he sort of saw the land from a distance, but didn't go inside. So in Jewish tradition, this event is very significant, and I do want to try and unpack it a little bit, because this day is actually coming up, and it's something called the 9th of Av. So in the Jewish calendar, the 9th of the 5th month is a very sad day, and I'll explain some of that. It hasn't happened yet this year. It's going to probably happen in the next 4 weeks or so. I can't remember exactly when. So in Jewish tradition, this day is the start of very, I guess, I'll call it bad luck. I mean, I don't really believe in bad luck, but quotation marks, bad luck. And our sages teach that on this day, God will punish future generations. So in the Gemara in Tanit 29a, it says, Rabbah said that Rabbi Yochanan said, that night was the night of the 9th of Av. The Holy One, blessed is He, said to them, you wept needlessly that night, so you wept for nothing, and I will therefore establish you a true tragedy over which there will be weeping in future generations. So what it's saying here is that, you know, on this day, which the sages say is the 9th of the 5th month, now Av is not actually technically, you know, Jewish name for the month, so I'll use the 5th month. The 9th of the 5th month, you know, they obviously cried for no reason because God was going to deliver the people and was going to rescue the people anyway. However, the sages say that there's a tradition that God made this day into a day which genuinely bad things will happen to the nation and they will be punished throughout history. Now, this sounds like very superstitious, and that's a fair enough thing. But however, we'll examine a bit of history which actually supports this as well. And it's not entirely unbiblical either, because we do read about in I'll talk about this later. In Jeremiah, there was a fast of the fifth month. So there has to be something bad to fast on for there to be a fast. So it is not entirely unbiblical. And how is the ninth of Av actually figured out? So yeah, you can actually, I believe, figure this out from the Bible as well. So I want to go through it with you because I do think it's significant in Jewish history. So in Numbers 10, so I'm going to take it from a few portions now. From Numbers 10, verse 11, it says this verse. And it came to pass in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, that the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle of the testimony. So we're in year number two, and we're on the second month. So remember, Av is the fifth month. The second month of the 20th day. So it's like month 220. Let's keep that in our minds. And in Numbers 10, verse 33, and they set forward from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey. So that takes us to the 23rd day of the second month. After that, the Jews complained about not having meat, and they ate it for an entire month. So in the lunar calendar, so that was what the Jewish people followed. It was 29 or 30 days, depending on the month. And basically, in that month, it was 29 days. So if you do 29 days plus, add 29 days to that date, you get the 22nd day of the third month. And then on the 29th of the third month, the spies were sent out for 40 days. So that's Numbers 13, verse 25. And the third month normally has 30 days in the lunar calendar. Now, according to tradition, again, this is something we can't exactly verify, but something which is likely, the fourth month that year had 30 days, not 29. So oftentimes, you could have one day of 30, one day of 29. That's what often happened. But according to the Gemara, according to Jewish tradition, the fourth month of that year also had 30 days. Again, impossible to prove without access to the records at the time, but which there probably weren't. I think you can sort of, if you know exactly what year it is, you can go back and use calculations. I don't know exactly how that works. I'm not really an expert in that. But anyway, according to the Jewish tradition, the fourth month had 30 days. So the reason that's significant, if you start from the 29th of the third month, you have 2 days, the 29th and the 30th, and then the next month would have 30 days, so you get to 32 days, and then you have 8 days, of the fourth month would have 30 days, and then of the fifth month you have 8 days, and then when the spies came back on the ninth day, which is the ninth of the fifth month, the ninth of Av, Tisha B'Av, then the complaining happened. So if you figure it out this way, again, I'll put these slides up so you guys can look over the calculations again, you actually end up the ninth of Av. So again, biblically, you can figure it out that way. If you basically rely on the tradition for just one thing, that the fourth month had 30 days. So again, even if it had 29 days, that's the other possibility, you still get pretty close. So again, there is some biblical basis to this tradition. And in accordance with the Gemara, on this day, God would bring genuine reasons to be sad for the nation of Israel, and history has proven this to be true. So for all these dates here, I'm not relying on Jewish texts. These are historically, verifiable dates, if you want to research these. So the destruction of both temples on Tisha B'Av as well, the final defeat of Bar Kokhba at Beitar in 133. So Bar Kokhba was a guy who was hailed to be the Messiah by many in the nation, and he led a revolt against the Romans. He was quite successful for a time, but he was defeated eventually, and that was on the 9th of Av. The expulsion of the Jews from England in 1290, and when the Jews were expelled from England, they were not invited back until the 18th century, so it was quite a long time. The expulsion of the Jews of Spain, also of Portugal as well, I forgot to mention, 1492 and 1497. Of the Jews in Spain in particular, so the decree which actually expelled the Jews in those days was called the Alhambra Decree, and that was given on the end of March of 1492, and it wasn't revoked until 1968, so almost 500 years later, so a long, long time, you were not allowed to be Jewish in Spain. Technically in the 19th century, Jews slowly started coming back after the end of the Inquisition, but technically by law, you were not allowed to practice Judaism in Spain until 1968. A pretty terrible thing that happened to the Jews. And the date they specifically set was the last day of July that year, which was Tisha B'Av. So, again, historically verifiable. You can actually read the document online if you want to. And also the start of World War I was in 1914, was also on Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av. And many historians believe the events of World War I set the course for the Holocaust and World War II. And it makes sense in a way because So Germany obviously lost World War One. They were humiliated, they were defeated, they were poor, they were really struggling a lot in those days. And it was in that environment that Hitler came to power. You know, people say in a more stable country, in a country which was, you know, not going through the ravages of, you know, post-war reparations and economic crisis and social unrest, that a guy like Hitler would never have rose to power. Who knows? But that's an argument that people make, and it's quite a, you know, it is a logical argument. And that, of course, sets into course the events of World War II. So these are only a few examples. There are more in existence. One that comes into my mind is in 1985, there was an attack on a Jewish center in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, which also happened to be also the 9th of Av. And that was the most devastating in terms of deaths, attack on a Jewish place in Latin American history, Latin American Jewish history. So, you know, even from the historically verifiable data, there is that does seem to be an association with the 9th of Av and bad things happening. So oftentimes in Ashkenazi or European tradition, in a few weeks before this day, people don't get married, you don't go to court. If you want some, if you want good fortune to happen to you, you don't do it at this time, essentially. So a bit of superstition there, but it does seem to have some historical significance. And as a result of the above, this day is the saddest day in the Jewish calendar, and it is commemorated by fasting, lamenting, and genuine weeping. There are a lot of people who genuinely, I've seen this, it's crazy, like, there are people who genuinely cry. I've seen, like, you know, oftentimes we remember sad events in our history, you know, let's say the Anzacs, you know, let's use an Australian example, the Anzacs, where in World War One, 60,000 Australian soldiers died, and it's a really terrible tragedy in Australian history. And obviously you have, as people should be, commemorating it year after year on Anzac Day. Unless you were there, it's very rare to see people genuinely, you know, as in, you know, obviously you're sad and you're serious on the day, but to see people genuinely crying is unusual. Of course, it probably happens, but it's unusual. Now, on Tisha B'Av, like, I've seen people, like, genuinely crying. It's pretty intense. It's a pretty intense day, anyway. Yes. So, in summary, this parasha is a reminder of a serious failing that occurred among our forefathers. God's wrath was kindled, and we have paid the price for ever since. However, we must also remember that God also showed great mercy. At the intercession of Moses, God spared the generation an early death and allowed them to live full lives in the desert. And, you know, living a full life in the desert is not as bad as it sounds. There are many people who, to this day, are nomadic desert dwellers, like the Bedouins, for example. Many North African tribes are nomadic desert people. So living a nomadic life in the desert was not a humiliation by any means. So God actually was quite merciful in his punishment here. And also, in addition to that, he actually provided for them everything they needed. Like, the manna kept falling for 40 years, and they had the cloud and they had the fire. So God provided for them in that time, which doesn't sound like too bad a punishment. But I'm also reminded of our hope of Messiah, how God promises that when all is fulfilled, our fast days, including Tisha B'Av, will become days of joy and feasting. So this is the reference in Zechariah. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the fast of the fourth month and the fast of the fifth and the fast of the seventh and the fast of the tenth shall be to the house of Judah seasons of joy and gladness and cheerful feasts. Therefore love, truth, and peace. I'm also reminded by this in the New Testament when the Pharisees, Jewish establishments were asking Jesus, you know, why don't your disciples fast? And then, Jesus says to them, you know, I'm the bridegroom, I'm here. How can the disciples fast? When he also does obviously allude to the time when he will leave, and then they will fast after that. But it does sort of really solidify the notion that when the Messiah is here, we will no longer be fasting out of sadness. There will be times of joy, and the fast days will become joyous days, and including the fast that is the 9th of Av, the 9th of the 5th month. Anyway, we'll stop there. I'll say this prayer for us, that actually Tamir wrote for us, but I'll say it together, and then we'll continue with our service. All right, please rise. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, God of the King of the universe, Rock of all worlds, righteous through all generations, faithful God, who says and does, who speaks and fulfills, all whose words are truth and righteousness. Faithful are you, O Lord our God, and faithful are your words, and not one of your words shall return void, for you are a faithful and merciful God and King. Blessed are you, Lord God, faithful in all your words. Amen. All right. Well, once we get this.